All right, so this is what I refer to as Britain's ABBA. Linda, do you know what it is?
Is it Bucks Fizz? Bucks Fizz?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's terrible. Who knew that was hiding in the
Heard of Bucks
road?
Fizz, Edamon?
No, I've never heard of Bucks Fizz ever.
Bucks Fizz.
How do you
spell? Like fizz, like a fizzy drink.
Oh, Buck Fizz.
Bucks Fizz.
Okay. I think it's one of those projects like I did with Kate Bush. I need to get into Buck Fizz now.
Was that just a one-hit
wonder? Well, you don't have to get into it because it was a while ago.
Okay.
Kate Bush, yes, get into it. But there's nothing to say about Buck Fizz, Ed, that I can give you.
First of all, terrible name. I mean, that's all I got to say.
Yeah, well, don't go out buying Bucks Fizz because you might not get them.
Yeah.
Anyway, I play that because it's been 40 years since Bucks Fizz won Eurovision with the song. It was at that moment we realised our lives had changed with a silly three-minute song, says member Jay Aston of the 1981 contest, where the British pop band reigned supreme. Bucks Fizz, well, they were a ragtag of showbiz hopefuls who'd only known each other for a matter of months, but were about to be catapulted into overwhelming success, racking up 3 UK number ones and 9 top 10 hits in the following 2 years and becoming one of the best-selling UK acts of the 80s, writes Mark Beaumont in The Independent. As they rocketed towards 50 million record sales worldwide, the pressures of huge overnight success on a group of people who barely knew each other began to cause frictions, and they fell out quite badly. But I do believe that a couple of them are still going. Linda, what are you doing? You're showing. There they are.
They look a little bit like Steve Irwin's.
It's a naughty name, and it's just they didn't get that high in terms of success as ABBA, of course.
No, they didn't.
I didn't realise they had more than one hit. I'm going to have to Google and see what they were.
The Camera Never Lies.
That's another one.
But you can clearly recall that song, can't you, Linda?
Yeah, well, that's freaky because I was only like 7 years old at the time.
Yes. Yeah. All right, it's 25-5, the panel. RNZ National, big response to the EV, electric vehicles. So we'll try and sneak in a bit of that later on in the program. To this, though, Labour MP Kieran McInerney has put up a members' bill to remove restrictions on alcohol sales over Easter, Christmas and Anzac Day. This would remove the current laws that require restaurants and pubs to sell alcohol only to people who are dining on Easter Friday or Christmas and not sell alcohol before 1 p.m. on Christmas Day. He was quoted in an article by the New Zealand Herald's Claire Trevett saying, "I went to Easter Sunday Mass, and if I wanted to get a pint afterwards, I should be able to." Incidentally, Chris Bailey, ACT Party MP, has also prepared a bill to remove alcohol restrictions except Christmas or Anzac Day, and also removing shop trading hour restrictions. With us is Dr. Nikki Jackson, who is Executive Director at Alcohol Health Watch, a charitable trust whose mission is to reduce alcohol-related harm and inequities. Dr. Jackson, kia ora.
Kia ora.
So, Kieran McInerney takes the view that buying alcohol over Easter should be an individual's choice. What do you think?
Well, it's not when we all suffer the effects of alcohol harm. Look, from an equity perspective, this just doesn't ring true. You've got communities that are demanding greater controls, greater restrictions on alcohol, and we're talking about opening off licences for an extra 3.5 days. Are they the ones that are going to front communities and say, well, we're going to increase, you know, availability? Look, I think we've got easy access in this country, and while I understand that these 3 Easter days and other days, you know, may have less relevance in today's context, we're still talking about increasing access of our most harmful drug.
It is all a bit about relevance, isn't it? I mean, if people don't wish to drink on Good Friday, Easter Sunday, they don't have to. But why should we stop others if they wish to, Nikki?
Well, I think, you know, yes, you could make this about personal choice, but goodness, New Zealanders could probably do with 3.5 days of not drinking, and they can stock up beforehand if they want to go to a bottle store. You know, police have less apprehensions over Easter, EDs are quieter. You know, I think there's a lot of benefits to be gained by having 3 days away from alcohol. We won't be supporting this bill. And if you look at all 4 private members' bills in the biscuit tin at the moment around alcohol, sale and supply, they're all pro-business. And when is it communities' turn to have some protections around alcohol? We continually move in the wrong direction, but we're never pulling back the reins on this. And, you know, look, I would almost happily trade up these 3.5 days if you give me good pricing policies, good advertising policies, good availability policies. But in a pro-drinking context that we have in New Zealand, to keep kind of tinkering at these edges and make it easier, relax the laws, that's not the direction that we should be heading.
All right, Linda, what do you reckon?
But, Nikki, you don't honestly believe that no one drinks on those days, though, right? Like, anybody who wants to drink is just going to stock up beforehand.
Yes, but we do have less harm, and that is shown in statistics. So,
isn't that because of chocolate, though, and Christmas pudding? Like, not to be facetious, but do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, people are together with their... I can't see that actually bears true. Like, if you think... I mean, we all just got some beers in the day before, for example, and I assume that most people who want to drink know that the shops are going to be shut. It's the same as the supermarkets. You know, you go to the supermarkets the day before and everyone's loading up. It's only half a day without a supermarket, but no one can cope. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, so, less consumption is always better, and there are so many benefits from drinking less. And I think that is, you know, what we want New Zealanders to practice. We have so many New Zealanders that don't take at least 2 days off their drinking. That all the numbers of these days is important. Let's take stock of our drinking. Let's think about our drinking. Do you know? Yes, stock up, but do we really need to go out and spend time drinking?
All right, what do you reckon, Ed? Is it time to just a few days of reflection to take stock of how we drink as a nation? What do you reckon?
Yeah, it's a good idea to do a reflection on your drinking. I would suggest that you turn it around. You have these restrictions across the year. You can't drink until you buy food across the year, and only Christmas and Easter time. Go ahead, do whatever you want. Right, so it kind of most of the year is covered, and it's quite good to have food while you're drinking anyway. But my point was that why, just the question to the panel and everyone, why do we have it? Why is this rule? Is that a religious thing?
Yeah.
Okay, so Jesus.
And
said,
I assume it's also a respect on Anzac Day. I mean, I could understand Anzac Day more because Anzac Day isn't a day of family celebration the way that, say, Easter and Christmas are.
Okay.
Even for those of us who are non-believers, you know, like we spend both of those, we spend those days together with our family, and occasionally you have a drink or tea.
Nikki, you must admit that it's a bit confusing, though, right? You can go to the pub, order chips that won't get you a beer, add a piece of fish, and you can get a pint.
Yes, yes, look, I totally get that. But, you know, and that is modelling, I guess, you know, drinking it in a way that's going to reduce intoxication, reduce harm to others. I don't think we're asking much for 3.5 days to be... I'm particularly concerned about the option in this private members bill, which increases off-licence availability. 75% of our very cheap alcohol comes from bottle stores and supermarkets. And you have to admit there will be impacts of this bill if those bottle stores are longer and people can make opportunistic purchases than they're drinking. So
are they
going to front up to communities and tell them that this is what they're having to do?
Right,
Hang on, just turn your head there, Nikki, so I can get a better reception there. Problem with cell phones today.
More sense then if your aim is to reduce alcohol availability? It would make much more sense to lobby really hard then on having fewer liquor stores available all year round.
And that's what I mean. If we had strong policies in place around increasing the price of alcohol, restricting availability, trading hours and the number of outlets, and advertising, then I don't think we'd be having this argument because we would have a strong policy context that signals the harm from alcohol. But when you put in these laws in a context which is pro-drinking, then I do think we need to take a step and go, well, this is in the wrong direction.
All right. Dr. Nikki Jackson, Executive Director at Alcohol Health Watch, thank you for your time. And I'd be very interested to hear from you. What do you think about this issue? Do you agree or would you support, if you have the chance, to remove restrictions on alcohol sales over Easter, Christmas and Anzac Day?
Like, what a great New Zealander Kieran McNulty is driving around in his red petrol ute and fighting for our drinking rights. It's for me, what makes more sense is the other bill that is coming out in terms of the trading hours. That is a more useful bill. This is useful as well, but it is just I don't think it's going to make a such huge impact as it was mentioned before.
Okay. Sue says, kia ora, Wallace. In Paris, most shops were shut on Sunday. When I lived in England, the pub was only open at lunch or dinner time on Sunday. I think we should keep the few limits we have on shopping or drinking. You don't agree, Linda?
I guess if you don't have a religious connection to Easter, then it's hard to understand the restrictions.
Yeah, and it's and I do understand that there are problems with alcohol, with equity issues, and people's consumption problems, and domestic violence, etc. So I do understand the points around keeping the restriction.
Another one here: I fully support removing alcohol bans on Christian holidays. People will stock up in advance if they want the alcohol. Why should we be dictated by one religion? Be smarter with alcohol education, not dictating to people when they can purchase. It's 7:05. The panel, RNZ National. You are with this afternoon, former editor of NZ Gardener and journalist Linda Hallinan, and comedian and podcaster Ed Amon. By the way, what's the name of your podcast again?
Baboon Yodel.
Baboon Yodel. Y-O-D-E-L. Very good. All right. To this, there's been a call to put in coin machines. Coin machines banking smart hubs in rural districts that are losing bank branches. The hubs provide smart ATMs, tablets and phones, along with at least one concierge employed by the pharmacy where the smart hub is located to assist customers who need extra support. Now, banking hubs have been on trial throughout the country for the next year to provide a place where customers of the major banks can perform basic banking transactions. So we thought we'd check in to see if these banking smart hubs are working and providing a good replacement to the local bank branch. With us is South Wairarapa Mayor Alex Behan. Alex, you've been a vocal champion for rural banking services. Welcome to the panel.
Thank you very much, Wallace.
So how are these hubs working in your viewpoint?
Well, there are four banking hubs around the country in rural districts, and each one actually is slightly different. And the concept was that the government would be able to then look back, and the Bankers Association look back and find out which type of hub actually worked best and then possibly implement them. So certainly in our district, which is the South Wairarapa, and it's based in Martinborough, we have a banking hub, and it's available, and it is manned by the information centre,
right,
but is really an ATM with also online services available and help provided by the people who run the information centre.
You have been a district who have been quite affected by bank withdrawal, because I understand that, in fact, you mentioned that no bank employee within 3,000 square kilometres of South Wairarapa.
Yes, that's true. The closest bank is one branch in Carterton, which is in a different district, and that's only on limited hours, 3 days a week, 4 hours a day. So our people need to either travel to Lower Hutt or to Marston in order to do any actual face-to-face banking.
So tell us a little bit about what a hub looks like. It's located within another store. You go in, it looks like a big ATM machine. There's a person on hand to give you a bit of help. Is that what, which is important?
I think that's part of it. And the pubs are a great idea, given that we don't have any actual bank branches. My problem, and where I conflict with possibly the Bankers Association, the government, is saying this is a placebo for some of the issues that are being caused by the withdrawal of banking services from rural communities.
There's an interesting point in this piece on Stuff about this banking hub, which is, you know, one of the local cafes said that they're near the ATM, and which spits out $50 notes, and then everyone goes and buys a coffee so they can break it for change. And I've always wondered that too. Like, why do ATMs just hand out 20s and 50s? It's really hard to break a 50 in a small town. Like, why aren't they giving out 5s and 10s and 20s then? I mean, that would fix the problem of not enough change, right?
It'd help, but certainly if you're the nearest bank, say if you've got a cafe on the coast of the South Wairarapa, and it's a three-hour round journey to go and get your change, that actually makes it worse, you know, when you have lots of 20s and 50s. So it's a very good point.
So these hubs then, what type of denominations are coming out of it? If you're going and you don't get the help of the person there, and you try to get out the money by yourself, do you get coins?
No. Right. No, so this was an alteration, I think, to the it was suggested by, again, Kieran McInulty, and I approve of it.
Great New Zealand.
He's been very busy, hasn't he?
I think it's
that's what happens when you get a day off without drinking. You come up with all these new ideas.
But certainly, I mean, given that the trial is underway, I think it's a good idea to adapt it to see if that helps some of the issues that we're having.
Very nice to have you with us. Oh, by the way, before you go, Alex, because the nub of the issue was a lot of people strong empathy towards their local branch. They see it as quite a loss of community once their branch goes, their local bank. Yes. How have people in general found these hubs?
I'm going to reserve comment until the government assesses all four. And all sees right. which one was best. And I don't want to be a negative because but I don't think they're fulfilling all the issues that everyone thought they might.
All right, nice to have you on the program, Alex. Thank you.
No problem.
That is South Wairarapa Mayor Alex being there. It's 12 away from 5. The panel is in national. Big response regarding electric vehicles. So I thought I'd just read out one. And you can keep them coming. Just wanted to give my 10 cents worth on EVs, says John. So we purchased a Hyundai Kona at the end of last year. Expensive, but we thought using some pension money to reduce our carbon footprint would be good for the planet. Sounds like a bit of an ad, but I'll read it out. I love the amazing acceleration as well. As well as the smooth, quiet driving. I hope he's not working for Hyundai. It was advertised as having a great range of 450k. However, I discovered that careful eco driving stretches out the range to more than 540k.
Isn't that just classic for an old person, though, isn't it? I've got to say. Sorry to offend all old people. But isn't that brilliant, isn't he? He's just so happy he can get it to go even further.
Yeah. Well, for anybody.
On the smell of a non-oily rag.
Whatever the age, Linda. The cost of the equivalent of a tank full of petrol is only $14, much less than the $140 for the petrol.
Can I just say that actually if we're overrun with EVs and, you know, plug-in rides and what's it going to do to my dad and people like his, you know, generation who go to every single town and comment on the cost of petrol?
What are they going to talk about? You're seeing electric vehicles as an age thing. It's for everybody,
but
isn't
it's
it?
One of their main joys, isn't it, is commenting on the cost of petrol in small town New Zealand.
Yeah, and what happens to those people who you know look at the engine and start talking about gummy pipe is not leaking with the Donkey King and all that stuff that you get from the mechanic.
Oh, it's disappointing.
Anyway, thank you very much for your feedback on that. Well, in a fascinating article by Ruth Hill at RNZ, weeding out fake news and misinformation is becoming increasingly difficult in the new media environment where social media rules, an academic says. And that social media has been a game changer for lobbyists and politicians, allowing them to bypass mainstream media and speak directly to their legions of followers. And Dr. Catherine Strong went on to say, talk about something known as astroturfing, which is actually used a lot, even though it is considered unethical, but it's not illegal. So with us to discuss these points is Dr. Jess Spirenson Shaw, a public narrative researcher and the author of A Matter of Fact, Talking Truth in a Post-Truth World. Dr. Spirenson Shaw, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Look, tell us a little bit about this term. For those of us who might not know, the term astroturfing.
Isn't it funny? it actually comes from the idea you would have heard of grassroots movements,
yes.
which are movements that are built up from communities. And in New Zealand, we have a great term, flax roots movements, from Māori communities. So astroturfing is a direct reference to that, because obviously astroturfing is fake grass. And what it means is that corporations or industry bodies pay people, often PR companies or other underhand kind of organisations, to create these fake grassroots organisations, which then look to people like they're a community organisation that's advocating for a particular thing, usually around a big industry. So we've seen a lot of that in the tobacco industry and in the fossil fuel industry. So they look like a community group that's advertised.
So the example given in the article was and it sounds quite innocuous, doesn't it? The Association of Community Retailers, which was an organisation funded by Imperial Tobacco. So that's an example, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so astroturfing is a classic strategy used by big industries that don't want to see the kinds of policy changes, for example, that governments might be thinking about to improve public health or public well-being. So they'll start up these fake grassroots organisations to try and push the public in a particular way, away from perhaps these changes that are being suggested.
So that means that the work of a lobbyist becomes easier and easier now, because now they can just, they don't have to get to the MP, they can get to me directly, and then I can push the MP that it will be more promising for them to have a change in law in their favour. So in terms of regulation, obviously we are quite young in this process, we don't know. Is there something that can be done in terms of being able to create these fake organisations or dummy organisation on social media?
It's interesting. I think one of the really important strategies is actually media. And the reason for that is that mainstream media, like RNZ or public media, can do, when they're well-funded, can do a lot of investigation into these kinds of organisations. So they're actually a really important strategy to overcome some of that. In terms of regulation, I think there are various lobbying laws and policies which people have tried to get through over time. And I think it's really important to consider how, for example, PR agencies or people who represent particular industry bodies get to lobby MPs, but also then how they get to set up some of these organisations. It is really hard in social media environment, though, and it's hard because people are constantly being bombarded with information.
Yes.
So it's hard to see where somebody comes from.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
And how do you educate people to understand the difference between a bad source of bad information or misinformation and a good source of reputable information? Because that's the thing I think is the hardest. You know, often even in my own friend circle, people occasionally post things up, which, you know, sets my journalism, like, bullshit radar, if I'm allowed to say that, you know, off at a high siren, and they can't see that clearly even the name of the website that they're getting this information from is total and utter bollocks, but they just can't recognise the difference.
And I think one of the problems is actually expecting that we can educate people and expecting it to be an individual effort, because I think that that's actually going to be the hardest, most resource-intensive way to locate false information. So what we know is that there are things that you can do upstream. So, for example, the regulation, we think about how social media companies operate and the kinds of regulations that we have on their operations. One of the best things we can do, actually, if we are talking about kind of raising people's critical thinking skills, is we can actually highlight for them the types of strategies that these bodies will use. So highlighting, for example, astroturfing. Another classic example that you'll see these kinds of industry bodies use is that they will create sort of fake science, or sometimes they'll throw doubt on the science. In the climate change space, we see that a lot. We might see like one or two experts who are probably who are anti climate change science, and they're being held up. And if they throw enough doubt, then the public might come to think, oh, maybe there is something in this. So we can highlight those kinds of strategies. The evidence is quite good, and we call that, funnily enough, inoculating people against false information.
Right, all right. Very interesting. Dr. Jess Berenson-Shaw, thank you very much for being on the panel.
Thanks, Wallace.
Dr. Berenson-Shaw is a public narrative researcher, the author of A Matter of Fact, Talking Truth in a Post-Truth World.
The strange thing is these are the sort of life skills that our kids really need to be being taught at school now. Mm. When I was learning to be a journalist, I remember we used to study product placement, and, you know, we were horrified at the thought that, you know, a character in a movie might sip a can of Coke or drive a Ford. Mm. And I remember, you know, we wrote whole academic papers on this, and, I mean, it seems so utterly naive now. Yeah. When you think how social media has just infiltrated everything with commercialism, with lobbying, with false information, and we've just sat there and let it happen.
Yeah, and also with the media articles as well. I mean, there will be a regular, proper, normal journalist article on Twitter, and then it will be tweeted as a position by a person and having an angle on it. And people usually then start retweeting and not read. Twitter has started doing this thing that if you try to retweet something, it asks you, do you want to read the article first? So that's a positive direction, but it is quite a mire out there to navigate.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
One thing that caught me by surprise today. So today there's obviously a viral video going around of the so-called three sons of the three tenors. It's on Facebook. It's been shared 812,000 times, including by five of my friends just today. The three tenors. It's three guys singing, and it's like, wow, look at this talent. These are the three sons of the three tenors. Well, it turns out they didn't have any sons. It's not their sons at all. But look, Facebook's put up a warning saying false information checked by independent fact checkers. And I'm like, how could they pick that up? And yet they've let all that other garbage go through.
Another one here. Joanna in Hawke's Bay says, I bought my little BMW i3 electric for approximately 180 kilometres with a small generator, which takes about $15 worth of petrol. That $15 will drive me an extra 100 kilometres. I'm so happy with my car and have had it for over 2 years. But sadly, no one else I know has bought one. I do think the infrastructure needs some serious investment, though. There are not enough public charging stations. So, are you convinced? Is your husband convinced to buy a fleet of electric vehicle trucks?
I tell you what, you know, I just tend to go with the flow. I managed to get over my addiction to shopping bags. I'm pretty sure I could get over my reliance on a petrol car. It's just a fascinating area, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's 2032, so close.
I know.
So close, yes it is.
You know, I'm gonna raunch my car up and down the motorway now. I'm going to do burnouts.
Good on you. Edamon, Lynn Helen, thank you very much. Back tomorrow.